sure wished I could see you like you can see me. Would you please turn the lights on? I've been after the good man up here to tell him, but he said they can't see me up there then. Well, I really don't care about that. I want to see you, really, because this is very, very difficult to speak if you can't see the audience. My name is Cease, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Cease.
And very, very grateful to be here, and I would like to extend my congratulations to everybody for putting on a deal like this on our 50th anniversary, because it is a, let's face it, it's really something, 50 years of Alcoholics Anonymous in Canada. And I would like at this time to thank you Americans for sharing it with us. Dr. Bob and... Dr. Bob and Bill got together with all the rest of the drunks, and they got down there and they wrote that book called Alcoholics Anonymous, 1939. And you shared it with us. And for this, I'm very, very grateful. It says here to talk slow. That's difficult for me. Because sometimes I do a little moonlighting and do some motivational speaking, and I'm a fast talker. But it reminds me of a joke about a church group that we're going to raise some money, and they decided to sell Bibles. And one lady went out and she sold half a dozen Bibles. Another one sold 10, another one sold 12. The fellow came in and he'd sold 143 Bibles. The minister got a hold of him and said, "My God, how did you do this?" And he called the whole congregation in and asked him to explain how he did it. And he said, "Well, it was like this. I would walk up to the door and I would ring the door bell. And when they came to the door, I would tell them that I am selling Bibles. And then I would ask them if they would like to buy one, or would they sooner have me read it to them." As I said, my name is Cease Corglin. I am an alcoholic and very, very grateful to be here. Matter of fact, I'm grateful to be anywhere. I'm not going to tell you a whole bunch about my drinking tonight because I don't think it really matters. I have never seen anybody up here by mistake. And I want you to know that I did drink. I'm not here by mistake. And I drank fast and I drank furious, but I didn't last as long as some people did. But this book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a tremendous book, and it tells me, in the doctor's opinion, exactly why I drank. It says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit that it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth and the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And then it says they are restless, irritable, and discontented. And I'm sure that you all agree with that. But when I was 16 years of age, I had never had a drink. I wanted to be an athlete. I was a pretty good athlete, but I had never had a drink. But when I was 16, without ever having drink, never having a drink, I became restless, irritable, and discontented. And right now, if they don't turn those lights on, I'm going to get restless, irritable, discontented again. I've got a lot of friends out there, and I told them to laugh at the right time and wave or anything, do things, and I can't see anybody. And I became restless, irritable, discontented, and I became, I didn't like the discipline of my home, and I didn't like the discipline of my school, and I didn't like the discipline of my church. And so I ran away from discipline. And to show you how smart I was, I ran into the army to get away from discipline. It wasn't one of my smarter moves, I'll tell you. And I got that big uniform on, and the first night that I was in the army, I went downtown with the rest of the men, and we went into a beer parlor. And I had a few drinks of beer, and some great things happened to me. All of a sudden, I was a great conversationalist. Some guy said something I didn't like, and I had muscles. And, oh, man, I told him where to head in. And then we went dancing. And, oh, you should have seen me. I was Canada's own Fred Astaire. For the benefit of the young people, he was a great dancer. Then I took a lady home from the dance, and I was Clark Gable and Charles Boyer, the great lovers of those days. But the next morning, I woke up in that armory's where we were stationed, and I was that scared little boy once again that had come in from the farm a day before to join the army. But every night, we'd go downtown, and I could be what I wanted to be. And it was just absolutely beautiful. I did very well in the army. I became an instructor. But I got kicked out when I was 17. And then I went back home and I worked in an aircraft factory. And I got a lot of responsibility in that job. And all of a sudden, once again, I became restless, irritable, and discontented. Because I didn't like the discipline and I didn't like responsibility. I know that now. And so I ran once again. And I ran back into the army. Told them I'd never been in before. And this time I was a genius. I was also a good liar. And then, there's somebody down there. I hope he can hear me, because I can hear him too. And I became an instructor, and I got recommended for my commission in the Canadian Army, and I'd love to stand here and tell you that I was an officer in the Canadian Army, but I got kicked out before I went away to officer's training. And I went back to Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, and I worked for a newspaper, selling advertising. Did very well. But all of a sudden, I got restless, irritable, and discontented, because I didn't like the responsibility that they'd given me, and I ran once again. This time I ran into the Navy. And there I settled down into a bit of serious drinking. I got recommended for my commission. I went to Cornwallis, Nova Scotia, for officer's training. And I'd love to stand here to tell you that I was an officer in the Canadian Navy. But I got kicked out of officer's training. It seems that an officer down there didn't appreciate me telling him what he could do with his ship. And I was in Florida recently, and I saw one of those ships go by. And really, it's a physical impossibility to do with that ship, but I don't know. But I didn't get kicked out of the Navy. I just got kicked out of officer's training. When I was in the Navy, I got married to a beautiful little Scotch girl who plays the bagpipes, as a matter of fact, as they were played tonight. I'm still married to her. I know that's not popular today, but she hung in there. I was in California last summer. I went down there for the earthquake. And that's a strange place. Big signs up all over the place. Divorces, $65. With buffet, $75. And, But that little gal is still with me today, and I was talking to her for a little while ago, and she said to tell you people that she hopes we have a good time. I became a gunner in a merchant ship, and I sailed all over the world, and I drank all over the world. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. Everybody was doing it. And then the war was over, and I came back home. And I start celebrating the end of the war. I start getting jobs, and I start losing jobs. I celebrated the beginning of the Korean War, and I probably celebrated the end of that. And I became a fighter the last 2 years that I drank. And I had 17 fights and 17 knockouts, and I lost them all. I didn't fight in any ring, I just fought in bars, because by this time I was drinking so much that I didn't like myself. And naturally you can't like other people if you don't like yourself, and I was very arrogant. I started to play a lot of poker when I was in the service. And I continued to do that when I got home, and I tell that because that's how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in a poker game one night, and I did an unforgivable thing. I got caught cheating. It's okay to cheat a bit, but don't get caught, especially by the guy that caught me. He was an ex-commando in the Canadian Army, weighed about 275 pounds, and he and I had a fight. Or I should say, he had a fight. He hit me, and I hit the cement floor, and I got up, and he hit me, and I hit the cement floor, and we did that a whole bunch of times. And finally, I just stayed down there, not because I wanted to, but because I couldn't get up. And they took me to hospital. And I was in hospital for 5 days. There wasn't anybody that came to visit me. I guess they just didn't know I was there. Today, I know they don't care. They didn't care whether I was there or not. But I had a little doctor that I'd been in the service with. And thank God for little doctors that tell you the truth. And this little doctor sat on the side of my bed in the fifth day that I was in the hospital, and he told me that he had done everything he could do for me. And he said, the rest is up to you. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, I was in the service with you, Cease, and you were bad then, but things haven't improved since you got home. And he said, I think you're an alcoholic. And he said, so the rest is up to you. And I said, what should I do? And he said, well, I suggest you join Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God he didn't leave it at that. That night, two people came to see me, two men. Uninvited, they just walked in to see me and told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. One was the sloppiest drunk in all of Canada, and I knew him, and I drank with him. And that night he looked good. His face was shiny and his hair was combed and he was clean. He had a beautiful brown suit on. And I knew that something had happened to Bill just by looking at him. His eyes were shiny. And he talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. The other fellow was a fellow that I'd been in the service with, and he found Alcoholics Anonymous in a penitentiary because he went to penitentiary for robbery with violence. And he had 5 years in that penitentiary, and he found AA in there. And he, too, came to see me. And I knew also something had happened to Earl. But he also looked so good, so clean, and a smile on his face and those shiny eyes. And they didn't even have to talk. They could have just stood there, and I'd have known that something had happened to them. But they talked, and they talked loud. And I was in a private ward that I'd given a bad check for. And that's before the days of Medicare in Canada. And I would try to change the subject. I'd say, how are things downtown? And they didn't even hear me. They just kept telling me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me about a meeting that they were having the next morning. It was going to be an emergency meeting for me. And that I was supposed to be there. And I had this bad check. And I know why I became an alcoholic. I became an alcoholic because I'm a Protestant. Don't laugh, you Catholics. I lived in a Catholic community, and they treated me bad. They called the bingos in Latin so that I couldn't understand them. And here I am in a Catholic hospital with a bad check, and that little nun couldn't find a place to cash it. And because I was Protestant, she wouldn't let me out until I paid for the check. And I phoned the only person that I knew in the world that my credit was any good with. And that was my bootlegger. And he was a taxi driver. And he came and got me and paid for the check and drove me down to this emergency meeting. Now, I didn't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. That really wasn't what I set out to do in life, was to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. But here I am, and there weren't a whole bunch of people standing out there wanting to hire me or anything, and I really didn't have any other place to go. So I went to this emergency meeting. And I'll tell you what I thought of Alcoholics Anonymous at the time. It's a story about three alcoholic rabbits. I don't know whether you've ever seen an alcoholic rabbit or not. We have them in Western Canada. I'm in the fur business, and sometimes I call them minks. But they weren't ordinary drunken rabbits or Saturday night. They were absolute, genuine, you know, alcoholic rabbits. And there were three of them. And they were called Foot and Foot Foot and Foot Foot Foot. And Foot Foot used to phone him Foot Foot Foot, and he'd say, "Let's pick up old Foot and we'll go down to the bar." And Foot Foot and Foot 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 pick up old Foot that went down to the bar, and Foot Foot was sitting talking to Foot Foot Foot, and Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, "Where's Foot?" And Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, "He's here just a minute ago, but he went outside." So Foot 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 and Foot Foot they went outside. They found poor old Foot, and Foot was dead. And so Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, "What do you think we should do with Foot?" And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, "I think we should take him to the funeral home." And after the funeral, Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, "What do you think old Foot died from?" And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, "I think he was alcoholic." And Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, "Do you think we're alcoholics?" And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, "Well, we're drinking quite a bit." And so Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, "Do you think we should join Alcoholics Anonymous?" And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, "Might as well," he said, "we got one foot in the grave anyway." And I was something like the alcoholic rabbit. I thought you had to have one foot in the grave before you came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I went to this meeting this morning. It was very cold outside. And I wish you could have seen me that morning. No, I really don't wish you could have seen me that morning. My shirt was torn and my suit was torn and there was blood on my, from this fight that I'd had and I had my coat collar up, my overcoat, so they wouldn't see me and all of a sudden they started to come in there. And at that time there were about 15 members in Prince Albert and they all came. In those days, when you got a live one, they all came. They weren't coming by the busloads, believe me. And I knew every one of them. And I hadn't seen some of them for a while. I guess they were going a different place than I was. And, oh, God, it was quite a deal. And I liked them. I really liked them. They said things that I really liked. And, man, oh, man, I found some friends, and I was really, really happy. Then they decided, after the meeting, that they'd take me home. And I said, no, I could go home by myself. You see, I didn't want them coming home because that little Scotch wife of mine, I'd taken people home before and she'd run them off. So I didn't want her to run these good friends of mine off, so I said I could go home. But fortunately for me, some of the ladies had been up to see her. There wasn't any Al-Anon at that time. And they had gone up to see her because they'd gone to mixed meetings and they wanted to tell her what we were doing. And they took me home and I walked in the door and she opened the door and she kissed me. And she said, "I think everything is going to be okay, hon." If nothing else, I stayed sober that day. Because she had changed already, you know. And And that was January the 16th, 1952. And because of you beautiful people, because of a loving God as I understand him, I never have had to take a drink since that time. I was 27 years old, and I'm sober for 41 years. It's simple arithmetic how old I am. But I know I don't look that old, so it's okay. And that night we went to our first meeting. And it was a social, a mixed meeting, it was a social. And I remember they played games. And they played pin the tail on the donkey. And that really wasn't my idea of a Saturday night. And all these people were old, old people. I mean, some of them were 45, 50 years old. God, I thought, what have I got myself into here? But then I noticed that Babe, my good wife, she was having a good time. Everybody was having a good time but me. And then they had a meeting after the social. And after the meeting, a couple of the guys took me in another room. And they had a little chat with me. And they said, in those days, they used to say there's no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, you heard that tonight. But they said, tomorrow morning, there's a meeting here at 8 o'clock and you must be here. And I'm glad they talked to me like that because I've never stopped going. A little guy that night put his arm around me and he said, Cease, we want you and we need you and we love you. And I didn't think anybody wanted me. I didn't think anybody needed me. And Babe had informed me that nobody loved me. And so I was so grateful when Bobby did that. He did something else to me that night that I'll never forget, and I'll be very grateful, and I think we should do it to other people. He said, Cease, we have two meetings a week at this group. Why don't you make a decision tonight that you're going to come to two meetings a week, and then you don't have to make a decision every meeting? That made sense. But I didn't think I was going to last this long. So I made that decision, and that's what I've been doing ever since, and I'm very, very grateful for that. And I started going to meetings, and man, oh man, I had a great time. I was the youngest member in the group, and they patted me on the back, and I stayed sober just by pats on the back. You know, they said, you're doing a fine job, kid, and I just loved it. Man, oh man, this is what I've been looking for all of my life. And then a horrible thing happened in that group. Some younger members came in. And they walked by me and talked to the older members, and the older members walked by me and talked to the younger members, and all of a sudden I became a middle member. And I don't care whether you're an Al-Anon, Al-Ateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous, one day you're going to become a middle member. And it's a bad thing. It's just like being a hole in a donut. You're nothing. And I felt like going out and maybe having a few and coming back and get the same treatment again, but... Thank God I didn't do that. Because we had a fellow in our group by the name of Ernie Sear. Ernie's gone to that big room, big roundup up top now. But we asked Ernie to chair our meetings, and we have discussion meetings where I come from. And he said he would chair them, providing we did one thing. And we said, what's that? And he said, well, we're going to take this group, and I don't care who comes in, we're not going to go back to step one. We're going to go through these steps in sequence. We're not going to talk about them. We're not going to study them. We're going to do them. And we thought we'd humor old Ernie along, so we said, okay, we'd do that. And thank God we did that. And that's the experience that I want to share with you tonight. The experience that I've had since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went to that first meeting, and Ernie gave us this, took the book, and he said, I want you to go home, and I want you to read the first 57 pages. And we went home and read the first 57 pages. Now, you may think that's an easy thing to do, but it wasn't, because we thought Ernie was going to give us a test. And we were phoning each other and saying, have you done your reading? And everybody had done the reading, and we went back the next week. And Ernie said, okay, tonight we're going to take step one, where we admitted we're powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. You know that I didn't even know at that time that there was a second part to step one about the unmanageability of my life. And I had an unmanageable life. I had an unmanageable life as far as money was concerned. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous owing $6,200. That's not a lot of money, probably, as far as you people are concerned, but that was 1952. You put it into inflationary terms, it's probably about $35,000, maybe. And I didn't owe it for anything. I just owed it. You see, I came here by way of a poker game. And I had a real good job. I was working for a real good company. And one day my boss got sick and tired of him getting phone calls and me getting phone calls.
We've got an emergency, apparently. Good night. Announcing that.
There's an urgent message here for Cassandra W. of Collingwood. Please come on site, registration desk on main level. Cassandra W. And he got sick and tired of me getting phone calls and him getting phone calls, so he took me to the bank and he endorsed my note for $6,200, and he and the bank, and I don't know why they did it this way. They sent the checks out to the people. They didn't let me do it. Funny thing, I don't know, I never did figure that one out. And he made Babe and I sign a paper that we would pay cash for everything, that we'd never charge anything. And 3 years later, he bailed me out for $7,500 because I had an unmanageable life as far as money was concerned. And I know you people probably don't even know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about financial problems. But I was the type of a guy that was, and I found this out in later on when I took a fourth step. I found out that financial problems have really nothing to do with money. But it has a lot to do with big shotism, has a lot to do with pride, has a lot to do with ego. And I was the type of a guy that would walk into a store and I'd want to buy something. They'd say, we got something here for $369. I'd say, you got something for about $700, you know, and I didn't even have the down payment on the $369 one. But that's the type of guy I was. If I owed you $400, I had too much pride to go and say, I can only pay you $100. I wanted to walk in and give you the $400. And that caused me a lot of trouble. And it caused me a lot of trouble after I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, you see, I didn't stop gambling when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought that I would be a better gambler because I was sober. And I kept on playing poker. And I'll let you in on a little secret. You can lose money sober in a poker game. It happened to me. And I tell you that I just had that problem with money and big shotism and pride and ego. But to show you that I've changed just a little bit. Many, many years ago, I owed a manufacturer in Montreal $10,000. It's not a lot of money in my business because I'm in the fur coat business. But it's a lot of money in the middle of July when it's about 96 above. And the manufacturer's calling me and wanting his money. And he's saying bad things to me. And all of a sudden, I wrote him a letter. I told him I liked his merchandise. I'd like to have fall dating on it. And then I threw a little philosophy at him. I told him that if I had 10 miles to walk down a railroad track, it would take a long time. But if I took it a telephone pole at the time, it would even take longer. But I'd finally get there. And then I signed it, yours truly, Cecil E. Corgle, manager of Cecil Corgle Furs and Fashions. P.S. I'm enclosing a certified check for $100. And I sent it away. 3-4 days later, I got a check, a letter back. That's when the post office was operating properly. And he wrote me a letter, and he congratulated me on my letter-writing ability, suggested that I get out of the fur business, I go writing letters for somebody. And he signed it, yours truly, Mo Amsel from Amsel & Amsel, Montreal. P.S. Would you mind sending me another telephone pole? I sent him a lot of telephone poles. I probably owe him some telephone poles today, but it's all right. I found out that it was okay to pay bills that way. And I had an unmanageable life in other departments of my life, but that was what was really, really causing a lot of trouble, and I admitted it when I took that first step with Ernie. The next week we came back, and Ernie said, okay, we're going to do step two, where we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Those days they didn't have any treatment centers, but they had mental hospitals where they used to send the drunks to. I'd never been there. So I said to Ernie, how could I come back from somewhere I haven't been? And he said, Cease, that's not what it means. It means you have a negative attitude. And we want you restored to sane thinking. And I had a negative attitude, believe me. I was something like the negative barber. Guy slid into a barber chair one day and he said, like a haircut to last me for 3 weeks. Barber said, why 3 weeks? He said, I'm going on a trip. Barber said, where are you going? He said, well, first of all, I'm going to London, England. The barber says, you're not going to London, England. He said, I am. He said, you're not. I said, I am. Wouldn't go there if I were you. He says, now, I've never been there, but I heard. Lousy place to go. Too many cars, too many people. Guy said, look, I don't care. Just cut my hair, but don't like it there. I'm going on over to Paris. The barber says, you're not going to Paris. He said, I am. He said, you're not. I said, I am. He said, I wouldn't go there if I were you. He says, no, I've never been there, but I heard they really fleece the tourists over there. Guy said, look, I don't care. If I don't like it there, I'm going on over to Rome. Barber says, you're not going to Rome. He said, I am. He said, you're not. I said, I am. Wouldn't go there if I were you. He said, a lot of Catholics over there. Guy said, I don't care. I'm a Catholic. Yeah, but he said, I heard there's a different kind of a Catholic over there. 3 weeks later, the guy comes back, slides into the barber chair. The barber says, how was your trip? He said, it was good. He said, it wasn't. He said, it was. He said, you didn't go to London. He said, I did. He said, you didn't. He said, I did. Loved to have stayed there long, but wanted to get on to Paris. He says, you didn't go to Paris. He says, I did. He says, you didn't. He says, I did. Loved to have stayed there long, but wanted to get on to Rome. He says, you didn't go to Rome. He says, I did. He says, you didn't. He says, I did. He says, you'll just never believe what happened in Rome. He says, I got an audience with the Pope. And the barber says, you didn't. He says, I did. He says, you didn't. And he says, you'll never believe what happened. He says, I knelt down to kiss the Pope's ring, and you'll never believe what the Pope said. And the barber says, what? And he says, where the heck did you get that lousy haircut? And I was something like a negative barber. I didn't know, but I heard, you know. I don't know whether that happens wherever you are or not, but I was the type of a guy that could sit around at a chair, you know, in a restaurant or something, trying to help somebody that wasn't there. You ever see that, Don? And they say things, have you heard? Did you know? Oh, I think it's awful, you know. And that, I could do that all day, providing I was talking about you. But in step two, I've had an unmanageable life. Step two, I found a manager. And I accepted that manager. And just about that time, I was at a ball tournament one day, and we'd won the ball tournament, and I was in the Army-Navy Veterans of Canada. And my brother-in-law came to me, and he said that old Van is over there, and he wants to talk to you. Van was about 65 years old. And I went over to Van and talked to him, and he said, how did you stop drinking? And I said, well, let's not discuss it here. Let's go home. And I took him home. It was only about a half a block to where he lived. And Van couldn't sit down. He couldn't lie down. He'd been drinking wine. He'd been drinking for days. And I walked and talked with Van all night long. And Van got sober. I told Van things that I didn't believe myself, but things that you had told me. And I talked to him, and I repeated myself, and I just kept with him because it was the first person I had the opportunity to take to the program. And Van came to the program, stayed sober, died when he was in his 80s, but he died sober. And he became a very, very good friend of mine, a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. All because I started to tell him what I had learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that night I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore my sanity. The next week we went back, and Ernie says, okay, we're going to take step three, and we're going to do it. Well, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Now, I know a lot of people say, well, I couldn't do it that way. Well, we didn't know any better. And I'm glad we were stupid enough to do it that way. And we did step three. And I remember going home. And Ernie says, all it wants you to do is make a decision. And he said, go home and read the third chapter, the third step in the big book. And you know what it says. It tells you all about how you want to be the director and the actor and the whole bunch. And that doesn't work out. You try other ways and everything. And I found out I didn't want to be that way. And I just went downstairs. And I said, God, I've made a lousy job managing my life. How about taking over? And I had to keep it that simple. Because I never, ever wanted to complicate things. And I kept it that simple. You see, simplicity is a great thing, and Dr. Bob talked about it when he talked to Bill in his last talk. And I believe it's so important that I keep things simple. I have a friend of mine that has a ranch. And another friend said, how'd you get the name of your ranch? And he says, well, I wanted to call it the Barbecue. My wife wanted to call it Susie Q. My son wanted to call it the Bar Susie Q, and my daughter wanted to call it Susie Bar Q. So we called it the Bar Q, Susie Q, Susie Bar Q, Bar Susie Q. And the guy said, well, that's a great name, but where are the cattle? And he said, none of them ever survived the branding. You know? And that's why it's so important to me that I make that decision. And that's why it's so important to me that I keep it simple. I don't know whether you people know what a poacher is when you talk about making decisions. Poachers, you know, they fish out whenever they want without a license, hunt, do whatever they want. And there was this old poacher and the game warden could never catch him. And a new game warden came to town, dressed up in old overalls, went down and made friends with the old poacher. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the old poacher said, well, I'm going fishing. And the new game warden, who he didn't know was a game warden, said, well, I'd like to go with you. So he took him out fishing. They got out in the middle of the stream and he stopped the boat. Reached over into a tin box. He took out 2 sticks of dynamite. He lit them, threw them into the drink. Boom, you know what happens? The fish comes up, out comes the net, and the old fisherman, the old poacher, thrown the fish into the boat, and out comes the badge. And the old game warden said, I finally got you, and he's giving it to the guy and he's talking to him. And the old poacher never batted an eye. He reached over and he got 2 more sticks of dynamite. He lit them and he handed them over to the game warden. And the game warden is sitting there with 2 lit sticks of dynamite. And the old poacher says, look it, buddy, do you want to talk or do you want to fish? He made a decision, I tell you. And that's all it asks us to do. And the third step is make that decision. And then it went to step 4. And Ernie, when it came to step 4, he brought pencils and paper for every one of us, where it says that we had to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And we said, what's with the pencil and paper? And he said, well, I heard people say that they can never find a pencil and a paper, and that's the reason they hadn't done it. And he took us this book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he took it to the page 65, and he showed us how to do a step 4. And we went home and did a step 4. And it should be the easiest thing in the world to do a step 4 because we're taking an inventory of ourselves. We were masters, or I was, of taking everybody else's inventory. And here all they're asking me to do is take my own. And I guess the reason we don't want to do that is because, you know, we don't want to find out just what is wrong with us. I heard a story about a sweet old lady, a society lady. She went to the doctor and she said, I got a problem. And he said, what's the problem? And she said, well, it's really not a problem. It's not giving me any problem. But she said, I have gas in my stomach. But she said, it's no problem. There's no noise and there's no odor to it. But she said, I'm always kind of apprehensive. So he wrote her a prescription. He sent her away. The week later, she comes back and she says, now I got a real problem. It's got an odor, but still no noise. Still no noise, she said. So he wrote her another prescription. And he says, now that we've done something about your sinuses, we'll see if we can do something about your ears. And I think that's what's wrong with us in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, or Al-Anon or Alateen, we don't want to take and find out really what's wrong with us. And we justify everything. But Ernie said, go home and take it. And we all went and we made phone calls to each other. And I phoned my good old sponsor, and I've had the same sponsor for 41 years. First night I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a guy there that I drank with. His name is Elmer. Sober 10 days longer than me, but he was an old-timer in those days. And I thought, my golly, if Elmer can stay sober, anybody can. I asked him to be my sponsor. He's still my sponsor today. And that's really great. I don't know if anybody else in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has had the same sponsor for 41 years. Because they've died, or they've quit, or they fired him or something. But old Anger, Elmer, he hung right in there with me. And that's a great thing. And I'd phone Elmer and I'd say, how you doing with your 4th step? And he said, I'm getting her down. And next week we went back. And Elmer and I were so stupid, we wanted to show them to Ernie. And Ernie said, no, 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 no. He said, this is something you do amongst yourselves. And so Ernie said, this week we're going to take step 5. And he said, this is very, very, very important. Where he says, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And a lot of people say they went and talked to another human being. Listen to what the step says. We admitted to ourselves, to God, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And Ernie told us about this. And I went home and I got down on my knees in the bathroom and I admitted it to God. Got up, went to the mirror, and you know what? I changed stories. And I went to a little minister, Protestant, mind you, and it tells us in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I hear a lot of people say they took their fourth, fifth step with their sponsor. I wouldn't take a fifth step with Elmer. He's a blabbermouth. Sober, he's a blabbermouth. But what if he got drunk? But on page 74 of the big book, it tells me what I can do. It says, rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. Those of us belonging to a religious denomination which requires confession must and, of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive it. Though we have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by an established religion. And that's what I did. And I'm glad I did, because I went to a little guy that knew all about Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd read the book, and he knew about a step 5. And he took my step 5 with me, and he shared a few things with me. So he'd been a kind of orangutan himself. And he and I became very, very good friends. And then he said, do you know what you have to do now? And I said, I have to go and read step 6 and 7. And I went and I took this book down, and I read step 6 and 7, where it says, we're entirely ready to have God remove all his defects of character. And then it says, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Now, I don't know whether this is right or not, but this is the way that I take it. You know, Bill said that the only reason shortcomings and defects of character, the only reason he used 2 things was he didn't want to repeat himself. But to me, where it says we're entirely ready to have God remove all his defects of character, I think that defects of character is doing something that you're not supposed to do. I think that shortcomings is not doing something that you're supposed to do. And I was bad for that. I wasn't doing the things that I was supposed to do like my grandmother had taught me. The little courteous things. Holding the car door for my wife, or holding the door for my wife. Little things like that. Please and thank you. All of those things. Telling the whole story and not holding things back. Because you see, many times we hurt people not by what we tell them, but by what we don't tell them. And I learned that in step 6. And I learned it in step 7. And I had, as I told you, I hadn't stopped gambling. In step 6, I asked God to remove the obsession to gamble. And I don't have to gamble anymore. And I'm very grateful for that. I used to swear a whole lot. And today, I don't have to swear a whole lot because I asked for help with that. I don't think I have any right to swear from this podium. Because I remember. I remember in our city, there was a lady going to Al-Anon, and I'd heard by the way the grapevine that her husband had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a businessman. And she came into my store, and I said, I hear some pretty good news at your place. And I said, she said, yeah, this, I don't know if that's good news or not, but he's made an effort. And I said, what do you think of it? And he said, well, I don't know. She came home, and I asked him how he enjoyed the meeting. And he said, it was a strange meeting. He said, they prayed a little bit. They swore a whole lot. They said the Lord's Prayer, and we had a cup of coffee and came home. That man never went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm not saying that that's what kept him away. But I know that at our group, that wouldn't happen, and I'm very grateful for that. In step 6, I was ready at that time. Because, you see, we talk so much about step 4 and step 5. that we forget about what step 6 and 7 is all about. Step 6 and 7 is where we start to change. And a lot of people don't want to change. I didn't want to change. I was something like the little granddaughter that was going to cook the ham. And she said, why do we, Mom, she said, why do we cut the end off the ham? And her mother said, well, I don't know, but Mom's here. She'll ask her. And she says, Mother, why do we cut the end off the ham? And she says, well, I don't know, but the great-grandmother's here. She'll ask her. And she says, great-grandmother, she said, why do we cut the end off the ham? And the great-grandmother said, well, I don't know why you ladies do it. She said, but I did it because I had a small roaster. And and I think we're a little bit like that. And you see, another thing, I was privileged to meet Dr. Little that came to this, brought Alcoholics Anonymous to Toronto. And I can remember him talking along with Jay Calder and myself and a few other guys when he visited Prince Albert. And we were talking about step 6 and 7, and he says, I think probably, he wasn't alcoholic, but he had it figured out, that probably people are afraid of becoming too good too fast. I don't think we have to really worry about that. I don't think that's a concern in Alcoholics Anonymous. Or Al-Anon, or Alateen. But here I am with step 6 and 7, and by golly, I found out that this is where I can really start to change. And I really started to change. Where step 7 says, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. I was having a difficult time to get down on my knees to pray. And I was in New York, and I heard a fellow by the name of Shy Walker talk about prayer. And he said he came out of prison, and he so much wanted to pray, so much wanted to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said he couldn't get down on his knees. And he said one night he had high-top boots on, he's working in construction, and he came in and he kicked his high-top boots underneath the bed. And he said the next morning when he got up, he got down on his knees to get his boots from under the bed, and he thought, by golly, I'm going to say a few words when I'm down here. And every night he used to boot the boots under the bed, so the next morning he'd have to get up, get down his knees to get his boots up. I don't know whether it works with high-top boots because I didn't have any then. But I know it works with ordinary shoes because I tried it. I don't have to do that anymore because I can get down and pray anytime I want to. And I think the only way that I can be humble is by getting down and praying. Arbutus, one of the oldest members of Al-Anon today, from Texas. I heard her say one time that humility, the definition of humility, is the ability to stand and the willingness to kneel. The ability to stand up for what we believe in. And the willingness to get on our knees and thank God for what has happened to us. And step 6 and 7 means exactly that to me. Next step, in step 8, they told us we had to make another list of all the people we'd harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And I went to Ernie and I said, I already made that list in step 4. He said, knowing you, Corgle, I know that you probably hurt someone before step 4, and between step 4 and step 8. And I had. He said, just make the list. And so I made the list. And I became willing. And I went on to step 9, where it said, we may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Every week, Ernie read the promises to us that come right after step 9, page 83 and 84. And he said, this is what you're entitled to. And he said, don't gyp yourselves. Get what you're entitled to. And I'll be ever grateful that Ernie taught me that. And I'll give everybody an absolute guarantee in this room that they will, if they will do the steps in sequence, they will get to have what those promises promise you. Because I've had those promises happen to me. And then we went on to step 10. Where step 10 says we continue to take personal inventory and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. Step 10, 11, and 12, to me, somebody said it was they were maintenance steps. I like to think they're growth steps. I just don't want to stay the way I am. I think if you maintain something, you keep it the same as you want it, same as it was before. I want to grow a little bit. My good friend Wesley Parrish, who's now gone to that great roundup, Wesley Parrish used to say, you got to grow or you got to go. And I like to take that word grow and I like to break it down. I like to take the G for gratitude, and gratitude is such a spiritual thing. It's something that really gets right inside of you. And I take the R for responsibility. Now, I don't like the word responsibility, never did, but I can find out if I'm grateful enough, I can be a responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a responsible member of my community, and a responsible member as a family man. And I take the O for open-mindedness. Open-minded enough to listen to anybody, no matter how cockeyed they may be. Just listen to them and keep an open mind. And I take the W for willingness. The willingness to be grateful and the willingness to be responsible and the willingness to be open-minded. And last but not least, the willingness to be willing. And I love that. And I like to talk about step 10 because when I was sober for 10 years, I forgot who I was and what I was and where I'd come from. I had a big job. I was working for the wealthiest man in the city of Prince Albert. And I decided he should be the second wealthiest man. And I went out in my great struggle to get those material things, and I got some of those material things. But in my big struggle to get them, I lost some spiritual things. I never missed meetings. I went to meetings. But I got real sick in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would go to a meeting and I'd be thinking something like this. You lucky people, here I am. I know none of you have ever thought that. If somebody wants a little counseling, maybe I'll spend a couple of minutes with you. I did a lot of penitentiary work, and I used to drive out to the penitentiary in my big car, and I'd think on the way out, boy, these people are lucky, the great one coming out here every Tuesday night. And one day my boss called me into the store, and it seemed that the store wasn't quite big enough for the two of us. I was managing the largest ladies' wear store in the province of Saskatchewan. I was looking after the furs for 5 stores. And I was big, I'll tell you. Oh. And we went into the office that day, and it seemed that the store wasn't big enough for the two of us, and it seemed that he owned it, and he wasn't about to leave. And he fired the great one. And I left that night with an attitude something like this. And they won't last long now. The great one's gone. They're still okay. That was in 1962. They're doing all right. And I went down and I had got myself some brand new clothes. And I went down to see a little cousin of mine who'd come to town. She was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stood up in front of Fern in my big egotistical way, and I said, well, kid, you know, how do I look? And Fern said these simple words to me, and I'm going to share them with you because they meant so much to me, because they brought me back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never been away, but they brought me back. And she said, you look real good on the outside, Cease, but how are you really on the inside? And I had a dear old friend by the name of Dave Murray with me when she said that. Dave's now gone to that big roundup. All of my friends are up there, as a matter of fact. And she said, when she said that, Dave and I were going to a roundup in Flin Flon, Manitoba. And we drove up there, and dear old Dave didn't talk to me because he thought maybe something was happening to Cease. I went into Winnipeg, and I spent a couple of days in a hotel room talking to God. And I went back to Prince Albert, and I went in business for myself. That's no big deal. But the big deal is that I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous with the right motive. And I'm still there today with the right motive. Because every night, I take a step 10. And I learned a prayer that my grandmother taught me. And that prayer is, please God, treat me tomorrow as I've treated everybody today. Be careful when you say that if you want to say it. And I try to use that prayer every night. Because I don't want to ever go through what I went through when I was sober 10 years. Step 11, where it says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Each and every morning, no matter where I am, I do a step 11. I read page 86, 87, and 88. I read the prayer on page 63, and I read the prayer on page 76. I read the promises. I read the last part of a vision for you. I read Emmett Fox. I may read Vincent Peale. Sometimes I even read the Bible. I know it's not conference approved, but I take a chance. And I have some prayer and meditation. And I do this every morning. Because you see, you never know who's out there to get you. There's always somebody someday that's going to aggravate your disease. But I get ready for them. And I do have a quiet time every morning. Sometimes it happens before you get out of the house that you live in. That little Scotch lady that lives at my house, I call her Mrs. I Want Money. And she'll be sound asleep, and I'll be going out the door, and man, she's right there, and she's got to have her hair done, she's got to do several things. And she wants to know if I got any money. And she has some money, but she wants my money. And you know what I do? I kiss her goodbye, tell her that I love her, and I don't give her any money. But I want to share something what happened to me when I was doing my reading a long, long time ago. I told you about our two daughters, Faye and Donna. Faye was the oldest daughter. We gave her everything. Gave her a good education, gave her material things, gave her love. And you will never believe what she did. She married a Catholic. An Italian one, the worst kind. And I was down in... She was living outside of Peterborough, and I was down there, and she had a little granddaughter. She had a little daughter. Her name is Anna Louisa, and Anna Louisa is with me tonight. And Anna Louisa was about 3 years old, and she was all dressed up to come home with Grandpa. And she came home with me, and the next morning I was doing my reading, and she knocked at the door. And Babe said, "You can't go in there, hon. Grandpa's doing his reading." And she said, "Well, I got something I want to tell him." So I said, "Let her come in." She came in. I took her up on my knee. And I said, "What did you want to tell me?" I explained what I was doing. I said, "What did you want to tell me?" She said, "I wanted to tell you that I love you." And I said, "I love you too." That may not mean anything to anybody out there. But here's this old hard rock that came to Alcoholics Anonymous unable to give love, unable to accept love. And here's this little Catholic girl telling me she loves me. And I'm telling her that I love her too. She has a sister. Her sister's name is Chela Maria. I don't know where they get those names. They're really not Anglo-Saxon, I'll tell you. And she thinks that everything that Grandpa says is the gospel truth. And I haven't told her any differently. She's a great little gal. Our other daughter, she has a son by the name of Jason. He's a Protestant. Jason's been a lot of places with me. Been to International Conference in New Orleans, the International Conference in... Anna and Jason came with me to Montreal. He's come many, many places with me. Been all over the country where I'm speaking. Not because he's Protestant, but he's just a kind of a good guy. He has his commission in the Sea Cadets now. He just became an officer. He looks like me, and he has that officer's uniform on that I almost got. He didn't tell that officer what to do with his ship. Kept his mouth shut. And he's a sailing instructor, and he's making money, and he's in university. And it's just a great thing, and we're pals. When he was in grade 11, he went from one school to another, and he went to a Catholic school. And he said to me, "I want to tell you why I went to the Catholic school, Cease." Calls me Cease. I said, "Well, it really doesn't matter. As long as you're going to school, Jason, I'm happy." "No," he said, "I want to tell you." He said, "The reason I went is that they've got a better spiritual program." And I accepted that. Isn't it wonderful what Alcoholics Anonymous will do to you? Gives you an open mind. And I'm really grateful that he did that, and I'm really grateful that we were able to share a lot of his spirituality, because we're really good buddies. Donna divorced her Protestant husband, and she too married a Catholic. Another Italian. And they have a little guy, 9 years old. His name is Giovanni Anthony. I don't know how to spell it. I just learned how to pronounce it. And he's my real pal. And he stays with me lots of times at night. And when we say our prayers, we always say, please God, treat me tomorrow as I treat everybody today. And he went home one day, and his daddy was up in his bedroom with him, and he had Gio down on his knees saying his prayers. And Gio said, when Papa Cease says, when I say my prayers, when I stay with Papa Cease, he gets down and says prayers with me. So Tony got down, and he said, to make up prayer. And when it was all finished, Tony got up, and Gio said, hold it. He said, Papa Cease and I always say, please God, treat me tomorrow as I treat everybody today. Tony accused me of teaching his kid bad things. But he's a little buddy of mine, believe me. And he and I have a great time together. And it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been privileged to pray with all of those kids because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, when I say that when you have a quiet time in the morning and you get ready for being out there, you never know who is out there, believe me. You just never know who is out there to get you. I heard another story about an old poacher. And the game warden tried to get him for 5 years. And he just couldn't get him. And the game warden's name was Ralph. And one night after 5 years, the old game warden, he went down by the old poacher's shack and he made a little bed in the hay. And he thought, by golly, when he comes out of here in the morning, I'm going to get him. 4 o'clock in the morning, the door starts to open and the old game warden said, I'm going to get him because sure as heck he'll do something wrong. The old poacher opened the door and he said, do you want some breakfast, Ralph? And old Ralph come out of the hay and he's in having breakfast and he said, how did you know I was out there? And the old poacher said, I didn't. But every morning for the past 5 years, I've opened that door and said, you want some breakfast, Ralph? And that's liable to happen to us, and that's why I do that. I have that quiet time. And then it went on to that beautiful 12th step, where it said, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Spiritual awakening to me is just a personality change. The fact that I could get up the other morning at 4 o'clock and drive to Saskatoon and catch a plane and come down here. And you know, if I was to say when I was in there, but I'd done my reading, if I was to say, holy malarkey, I have to drive to Saskatoon, it's raining, and then fly all the way to Toronto and go by Regina, and oh, I'd have been played out before I got out of the bathroom. But you know, I looked in there and I'm having a shave and I'm saying things like, in 1965, I was at the International Conference in Toronto. I'm going back to the 50th anniversary of AA in Canada. Aren't I a lucky guy? And you drive off to Saskatoon and your attitude is right. An attitude of gratitude. And then it says, we tried to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. I've probably made 1,000 12-step calls. And all of them have been a success. Some of the people are dead. Some are still drinking. Some are in mental hospitals. Some of them probably in treatment centers. Some of them have short terms of sobriety. Some of them have long terms of sobriety. But when I say everyone has been a success, is the fact that old Cease is still sober. And that's all it asked me to do. was to try to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. And then it says to practice these principles in all our affairs. The principle in step one of honesty. Principle in step two, hope. Principle in step three of faith. Principle in step four of courage. Step five, integrity. Step six, willingness. Step seven, humility. Step eight, brotherly love. Step nine, justice. Step 10, perseverance. Step 11, spirituality. And step 12, service to our fellow man. The greatest opportunity that we can ever have, the late King George said this, the greatest opportunity that any man could ever have is the opportunity to serve his fellow man. And we have that opportunity. And I hope that everybody will think about our 50th anniversary and they'll take advantage of that opportunity. I'm going to share something with you that kind of bothers me. I'm not running for everything because I've been everything. So I can say what I want. But I noticed that in the last Box 459 deal that I got, I noticed that our, you know, those that stuff that we're supposed to send into Alcoholics Anonymous, I think they call it money. I noticed that the contributions are down. They tell me that the population is up. And I have a difficult time understanding this. And I don't think it's anybody's fault except the people that aren't telling the people that are coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think we are having a problem with sponsorship. I don't think that we are telling the people everything that they should know about Alcoholics Anonymous. And if any of you people are real young and you want to know, go to some of the leaders in your group and say, what was that big mouth talking about when he mentioned that our money is down? And you'll find out that you can contribute to Alcoholics Anonymous because we're fully self-supporting by our own contributions. When I was delegate, I told a story. And I'm going to share that story with you tonight in closing. And I can remember when I was delegate in New York, I told a story out at a meeting one night. And there was a fellow from somewhere in the southern states. And he stood up and he said his name. And he said, Cease told a story last night, I'd like to tell it again. But he said he'd like me to tell it real slow. Because he said not only did he talk slow, he heard slow. And I told the story again and I told it many, many, many times. And the story is about a young member of Alcoholics Anonymous who said he was going to quit Alcoholics Anonymous. He told an older member. And the older member said, well, why are you going to quit? And he said, well, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, told me it wasn't going to cost anything. They told me I didn't have to do anything, just come to meetings. Now, he said, they want money for the assembly, they want money for the general service, and he said, somebody's having a birthday, they want money for that, they want money to pay the rent. He said, somebody's in the hospital, we got to go and see him. We have to go on 12-step calls and all this rotten stuff. And he said, I'm getting sick and tired of it, I'm going to quit. And the old member sat there for a while, and then in his easy does it way, he said, you know, son, I don't blame you a bit. Because he said, your story reminds me of the story of my life. He said, when I was a very young man, my wife and I were blessed with a bouncing baby boy. Someone told us that three could live as cheap as two. But he said, the moment that child was born, he started to cost me money. I had to leave my wife in a hospital. I had to take the kid home. I had to hire someone to look after her. I had to hire someone to look after the little boy. Every time I went downtown, he said, they wanted something special for the little guy. Then he started to creep around, and needed toys and different clothes. Then he went into public school. And there he said, I had to get him, the tricycle wasn't good enough, I had to get him another bicycle, and he wanted to go away to some camp, and he said, I had to get him stuff for sporting goods, money for sporting goods and everything. But then he said he went into high school, and there he really started to cost me money. He needed money to buy an old car. He needed money to go away to picnics and dances and all of these things that teenagers do. Then he said he had to go away to take the girls out. And he said every time he went somewhere, he cost me money. And he said, I was like you. I was getting sick and tired of it. But then he said, in the final year of high school, that boy of ours died. And he hasn't cost me a penny since. Do what you like with that story, folks, but let's keep Alcoholics Anonymous alive. So that 25 years from now or 10 years from now, we can sit in this same place and celebrate another great birthday. I want to thank the committee for giving me the very pleasurable privilege of being with you tonight. I want to thank you, the audience, because you're so great. You treated me so good because you listened and you made things so easy for me. Last but not least, I want to thank God for giving me one more beautiful day to allow me to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship that I love so much. And I'm going to close this talk the way that I close many talks. Every one of you look real good on the outside tonight. How are you really on the inside? Thank you and God bless you.